This is the Science Behind the Art, where we discuss the insights of the cosmetic industry through a different lens, uniting scientists and artists. We are the New York Society of Cosmetic Chemists. I'm Maria.
I'm Regina.
And I'm Leah. Join us as we embrace beauty and dive behind the scenes of the cosmetic industry.
On today's episode, we have Mehdi Doumi. Mehdi has been in the industry for 12 plus years at L'Oreal. Currently, he's an associate principal scientist leading the method development lab. They build instruments and analysis software to analyze nails, eyes, eyelashes, neck sagging, skin sagging, pigments, and much more. Basically, a lot of the properties that cosmetic products target. He started in the hair care department at L'Oreal. He has a degree in biomedical engineering from Rutgers University with a focus in image analysis and mathematical modeling. And he continued his studies there, where he created visualization for cancer and migrationary cells. During that tenure was when he was offered an internship at L'Oreal, and he has a master's degree in biomedical engineering from Rutgers University, and his thesis focus is 3D simulation of cells. Welcome to our podcast, Mehdi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us more about yourself. This is so interesting, everything I just mentioned about you.
Yeah, thanks. It is super interesting. So I guess my background, I was born in Algeria. I moved to England when I was 2.5, with my parents, of course. I didn't know how to fly a plane then. And then when I was 12, we moved to New Jersey, where I went to high school at Edison High School, so Eagles. And then I went to Rutgers, as you mentioned. And I've always been interested in the interplay between science and art. And when I was offered a job at L'Oreal that promised to work on beauty products, but also somehow science is involved, I had to take the offer. And for the last 8 years, I've been really happy working in the, I guess it's a very unique department. It's a department called Product Performance Evaluation. And the goal of this department is really to test the efficacy of the products that we're selling and that we'd like to. So for example, if you have a mascara and you're unhappy with the volume, our labs or talented chemists would try to come up with a formula that adds more buildable volume, let's say, in your mascara. But that needs to be tested. So before, we do a lot of testing at L'Oreal to make sure that safety is the first thing we pass, and then we need to test efficacy beyond that. And there's a lot of biases that people have if you made your own formula and you're putting your own mascara on your own eyelashes, you're probably going to love it. You know, it's your baby. Everybody's proud of their babies that they formulate in the lab. You're making at least 15 babies a year, just launching product. And so I was actually a chemist for 4 years working in the hair care department. So I was building shampoos and leave-in conditioners and sprays and serums and, hair masks, and you get attached to those formulas that you spent 7 hours making a shampoo. I mean, that's your whole day just on the bench making that, making sure all the ingredients go in. So you need a department to evaluate that. You need a department to say, okay, objectively, are we seeing more volume in this mascara? Objectively, are we seeing less frizz with this shampoo with cationic polymer? So you need a department to handle that. And the specific part of the department I work in is the instrumentation side. So I lead method development. And method development, basically, method is quite a general term. Method is any kind of set of rules that you have to follow in order to test something objectively with the least amount of bias. So me specifically, I work in method development on the instrumentation. So instrumentation includes cameras, sensors, colorimeters, spectroradiometers, spectrophotometers, things that measure color very accurately, things that are really critical to knowing what the difference is between two products. We're either comparing against different prototypes, maybe you want to compare against a competitor to see if we're at the same level of performance. So Yeah, method development is about, can I get this camera to capture something on somebody's face? And then can I get the software to analyze that image from the camera? And can the software give you an output that is similar to how a human sees the face? Because we all have biases. There are halo effects. If I give you a coffee that smells really good, it might affect how the color looks to you. Never mind it. We all obviously know that taste is 85%, but you might even change how you perceive the color. So, and when it comes to cosmetics, because it's very personal, you're rubbing foundation, let's say, on your face. Now, will that person who's rubbing foundation on their face, who likes the application, will they perceive that as a beautiful color matching foundation or as a long wearing foundation just because the application felt good? So my team has to try to get in there, quantify those objective attributes. Does it actually last longer than 6 hours? Does it actually even out your skin tone from a camera's perspective or from a sensor's perspective? And then once we have that, now the next really exciting part and the second half, you could say, of method development is, well, does a human see the same thing? And so we invest quite a bit in making sure that the instruments that we're creating to evaluate objectively are also consumer relevant. And that's where we start getting into the gray area of machine learning and AI, where, you know, can we produce an effective method so that, you know, our customers are happy, we're able to produce, you know, better and better products, we're able to test them more sensitively and more robustly, and the consumer's just going to be way happier because they're going to really see a 200% volume in mascara compared to some fake 200% volume of mascara on the package next to them on the shelf. So that's kind of what the purpose is of my lab and method development. I hope that. Very difficult, I'll tell you that. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I can't imagine trying to get a piece of machine to imitate the human eye. Just like a simple comparison when we're outside, we're looking at the sunrise and we're trying to take a picture of it. And it's like, might as well not take a picture and just capture this moment.
Example.
So
very good analogy, yeah.
I can imagine your job does not get boring. It's truly fascinating what you do. So the method development goes hand in hand with claim substantiation, I imagine.
Correct.
If you're trying to prove the volume. So it's extremely important for this industry. I think we're moving towards products being differentiated just by their claims. So you could have kind of the same ingredients, but if you're claiming something different, if you found a way to test that, that's where your selling strategy will be. So
which I think is a good thing because I think consumers are tired of seeing a funny, crazy story on the package of the lipstick. You know, will explode your lips 1,000%. I mean, what are we? These are lipsticks. These are surface coatings on somebody's lips. So absolutely, I think the consumer has lost perhaps a little trust over time, and in general, you know, we live now where we have infinite news sources. You can get news from anywhere. You can get facts from anywhere. And it can be quite overwhelming. And you have to try to piece out what's real, what's not. What I'm very happy about L'Oreal is that I am challenged, and people like me in my position in the company globally are really challenged we need to prove things, you know, we need to prove things that are very difficult to quantify. And I'm happy that there's a lot of ethics behind that. You don't want to just, it's very easy to make a marketing story, you know, and just to tell something cute or to show even an image needs to be vetted very, very carefully. Even if it shows like a qualitative difference. Oh, wow, I can see a big difference from this picture, like a before and afters. All that has to be really to be validated, has to be checked. And my team works with my whole department works with the claims substantiation team regularly. Oftentimes, you know, we come there, we propose, these are things that we can measure. And the question is, well, are those consumer relevant things? Are those the same things that a human can see, that a consumer can see? And then there's some more legal jargon that I don't understand, but basically it's a very bar. Yeah, it's a very high bar to get a claim on a L'Oreal package. So it's something we take extremely seriously, because when you're a big company, trust is everything. And so we're doing a good job there. My job is not getting easier, I'll tell you that. But it's quite a bit of fun, and it's very challenging.
Yeah, I bet tying technology to, I guess, mm-hmm. neuroscience and psychology is no easy task. So really admire what you do and what your department does to move this industry forward. And
thank you. I hope my boss is listening. Wow.
On that note, let's talk a little bit about color. So yep. there's so much about color. I know you've worked on some studies with color science. Yep.
Right.
Could you tell us, like, how would you measure color for somebody that has no idea? how
okay.
does that work?
So, right. Great. Excellent question. So color is probably the most talked about. So when I work on products, I'm looking at, there's usually three things. It's usually either morphology, so like the shape of somebody's face, or the shape of the wrinkles, or the pigments, or the amount of wear on a nail polish, that some of our scientists do that. And then there's light. So things like shine, radiance, luminosity, glow. These are like, you know, brightness, darkness, that's one aspect. And then color is the big one. So those two are very challenging, but color is even more challenging. Because a camera, for example, is just a chip, it's just a silicone sensor, and we create some algorithms that read in the photons coming off of somebody's face, turning those photons into electrical signals, which creates like a JPEG or a RAW file. And you hope that that conversion is consistent. You also hope that conversion is the same across different cameras. You hope when I say conversions, I'm talking specifically about the RGB values. When you were to zoom in an image and you see just numbers and it's an R level 200, a green of 50, and a blue of 12, that combines to create one color. So color is a three-dimensional thing in the digital realm. It's three dimensions. It's either RGB, red, green, blue. You can convert that to LAB space. So you have lightness, the range of green and red, and the range of blue and yellow that are contained within the two dimensions A and B. There's LCH. And people who study Photoshop know a little bit about this. There's like hue and chroma. So already the landscape of understanding color from a digital, perspective is already quite complex. And mapping is a key part of that. And mapping means, how do I know what I'm seeing is also going to be reflected in the camera? And then how do I know what I see in the camera is also going to be reflected what I see in a screen? And so ideally, one thing that's really hot right now, or has been in recent years, is augmented reality. And that's putting lipstick on your face via an app. And consumers want to do this because they want to know, hey, does this color of purple look good on my skin tone? Does pink look good on my skin tone? Is this gloss? Is this too shiny? Without wanting to put it on, which is even more a requirement when you have a lot more sanitary guidelines these days. So you need to see that color is accurate, that the color you see on your phone is the same color you would see if you're applying a lipstick in real life. That has a whole host of problems, because what if you're putting lipstick on in your vanity where you have 2700 Kelvin light bulbs, which are essentially the incandescent light bulb color, versus some of the newer LEDs, which are 5,000 Kelvin, or other 6,500 Kelvin, which are even bluer than the 5,000. And all of that, those color temperatures, basically it ranges from warm to cold. So even the environment that we're imaging and that we're, we have to consider that when building an instrument. And when it comes to building applications for like a home app, like I mentioned with augmented reality, you have even more considerations that you have to account for like maybe use to ask them to go in a special room to do it, or in a dark room, or use the light from the flash. So that's a long, long sort of preface for the complexity of color. But what we do have now is, if you're a student or if you're a young scientist in a lab, get yourself a colorimeter. I mean, these are devices that are not as expensive as spectrophotometers, but a colorimeter is going to reliably give you the color of an object, like the green post-it. You basically put it on top of there, and you get the exact RGB and LED values for a given color temperature and for a given angle of the light bouncing on the surface. If you have shiny things, for example, the angle is very important. If you're hitting it right from above, you're just going to get a mirror reflection back. So that's why there are also angular dependencies when it comes to how we see things in perceived color. So that's one of the basic building blocks that's in our portfolio of tools. And beyond that, we have spectrophotometers, where now you're actually getting the spectrum of colors hitting the sensor. This is super important because they're metamers. So metamers are, or metamerism is the phenomenon where this thing looks green here, and then if I go in another lighting, I have something else that would look green. And what's happening is the influence of the different spectra around you dictate what color you see. What I'm seeing is the bouncing off of the lights in my room and my window, bouncing off this thing. Some colors are getting absorbed, some are getting bounced back, going into my eyes, where they're going to get absorbed, and some are not getting absorbed. And my mind is doing the calculation all the time. A spectrophotometer helps you catch the spectrum before it gets in your eyes. And then you can start looking at the details behind, okay, what is it that makes this a color green? Is it the peak, the 510 nanometers, or is it the combination of the blue and yellow? So there's a lot of, each device you get is going to introduce a whole new set of variables. And then there's also color correction topics. So when we want to evaluate color, it would be ideal if you can just take a picture of somebody's face, especially if they're at home, or if you can't access that consumer, maybe they're in an environment that's far away from a L'Oreal facility or a testing lab. Ideally, you want to be able to get information like a selfie image from the phone and be able to quantify your skin tone, because wouldn't it be great to just take a picture of your face and then you have a foundation product that perfectly matches your face. Well, that's been attempted by companies before, but it is still very difficult to get the exact skin tone.
I don't think I've ever thought about color this way. There's so many layers of complexity. And as a chemist, for example, you think of, okay, I need to color match this. Let's get this to right. to the color of the benchmark or the color that the marketing brief says, whatever it is. And then when you go to your department, it's like, okay, wait, let's see if you really color matched it. Let's see how, like, when you're talking about the spectrospectometer and like just getting the curves, it's a whole nother field. So yeah. I think the skills that you learn as a chemist can definitely translate later on in your career, but it's a different mentality, so to speak.
Sure. So. Yeah, as a chemist, I was definitely not the best chemist. It takes a lot of patience, a lot of organization to be a chemist. It takes a lot of perseverance.
A lot of mistakes.
I think even small things like, you know, a shampoo can have 20 ingredients. And, you know, by mid-afternoon, you've been mixing the first four ingredients and you realize, oh, I forgot this third ingredient. And you can't just add it in because there's a specific process. There's crystallization that can happen. You can mess with pH. You can overshear, especially if you're dealing with an emulsion like a conditioner or a mask, you know, which is like yogurt type mm-hmm. consistencies. With method development, it is so broad that, I mean, I'm still actually trying to communicate that broadness effectively to, because the chemists are kind of like my customers. They come to my lab to ask, hey, do you have a test for this? Do you have a test for neck sagging? Do you have a test for under eye bag dark circles? Do you have a test for this? And if the test doesn't exist, I got to work on it. If a test does exist, it gets shifted to in order to operational teams, who are responsible for a ton of work at L'Oreal. They're really hardworking, smart, you know, members of the bigger department that I'm in about running tests. You know, so you have either external tests at vendors where we do some of our claim studies, or there's sometimes internal tests where we might need, we need 8 consumers to visit the facility to do a quick lipstick test or a foundation test.
Okay. So you mentioned the chemist comes to you and they're like, do you have this? And if you don't have it, then you have to create it, right? So what is most important to you when you're innovating other than the requirement, right? So if it's neck sagging, then we've got to focus on that. But how does your brain kind of like work through the innovation process?
That's a very good question. Innovation process. Innovating requires a blend of like scientific invention, creativity skills, all within the constraints of working in a business. And when I say constraints, I mean specifically time and money. Time probably is the biggest factor. The cosmetics industry is very trend-based. Some areas are less, like makeup, for example, is very trend-based. Contouring and highlights and dewy look and, you know, hairstyling also can be trend-based. Skin is a little less so. You know, we have seen more people move towards cleansing, for example, in 2020. So innovation is about keeping up with some of those trends and creating inventions that direct you towards it. So I'll give you an example. Eyebrows was a big hot topic about 5 years ago or 4 years ago. And the lab was challenged with, okay, do we have a way to quantify density of the eyebrow hairs, the orientation of the eyebrow hairs, wow, the thickness of your brow, the width of your brow, the angle of your brow? Are you happy or sad? And so in collaboration with a software in France, I added some new metrics to an eyebrow quantification software, which I actually presented the results of that poster, the results in a poster in Milan in 2019 at the IFSCC, International Federation of Society. So I was in Milan, lovely trip, and among 500 other posters, and, you know, shared this innovative software, this thing that is keeping up with the trends, was able to be written very quickly in about 3 months. It's not an application, by the way, you have on your phone yet, but it's something that maybe in 2 years from now will have perfect automatic recognition and analysis of your eyebrows, which can then, you know, recommend a product to you. You know, like what, if you have bushy eyebrows, maybe there's like some products around the outside to make it look thinner, or there's some teasing or some brush techniques. But innovate. So I just used that as an example of innovation because the software could have been better. We could have turned it into an application. It could have been deployed mobily. But what we did is we created a tool. We created a tool that takes us to the next level. And that next level is, okay, how do we make the app now? What more attributes are we missing? Do we need stylists to get involved? So I think the word innovation gets thrown around a lot. My definition of innovation is being inventive, being a creative scientist under the constraints of, you know, corporate needs. It's important to realize that too, because like we talked before, the topic of color is almost infinite. You can keep talking and trying to solve these little problems or little holes in our knowledge of color. But you're going to spend 5 years doing that and then never launch a product. So innovation is this balance between invention and, you know, production.
And you mentioned that the cosmetic industry obviously is very trend focused, and
yes,
some aspects more than others. Specifically, you said skincare is, we've seen more cleansing, we've seen more natural. Where do you see specifically color science moving towards?
So, everybody knows this probably, but, and maybe it's going to seem silly to you, but more things are becoming mobile. In my world, an ideal scenario would be when it comes to testing products, instead of having panelists coming into a L'Oreal facility, which does a couple of things. We have a L'Oreal facility in Clark, New Jersey. It's the hub of U.S. research and development. And when we want to test the efficacy of products, let's say two foundations we want to compare, is one longer wear than the other? Well, those people have to come in, and they're going to come in. They're probably going to be 50 miles radius from Clark, New Jersey. And most of them are within a much smaller distance. So just by merely having a facility somewhere, you kind of are limited to who lives in that area. So that's why we run global. Yeah, the demographics, right. And certain cities are more expensive than others. For example, it'd be great to have a hub in New York City, but that no longer becomes efficient because you really need quite a lot of space. New York doesn't have much space, and it's going to be more costly to gather results there. So that's why, for me, testing using these things, using our mobile phones, getting reliable information from a mobile phone, from a picture or maybe a video of somebody's hair, we can extract like quality data from that and then use that as a support and the case for, hey, this product is actually doing better because the sophisticated camera systems are seeing exactly the effect of that cosmetic product. I mean, that's going to open us up to the whole world, basically, and it's going to solve the we already are leaders in inclusivity, but this is going to be an even more inclusive, worldwide, globally foresighted approach to testing where everyone is included, all skin tones, all shine levels, all ages. Because of these damn annoying phones that are in our pockets that keep distracting me. But in a quick test that takes 2 minutes, I mean, there's a potential for just such a great amount of data that can then be converted to better products. It's really, so that from the scientist perspective, the head of method development, that's the path that I'm on. Color is hard to measure when you're not in the ideal environment. So it's everybody's like, that's the holy grail, right? That's the holy, I mean, everyone's trying to get everything done on the phone.
So going back to the beginning of our interview, you mentioned your career path and how you started as a chemist, and now you are the head of a whole department. I mean, a super important department. I don't think many people think the scenes of the cosmetic industry and how much different sciences are involved in the industry.
Yes. Right.
So what is something that you would have liked to know when you started in this industry?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the one that just stands out at me is just the difference between graduate school research and business research. That's a big one. You know, when you're an undergrad, you hope that you can do research in the summer with some advisor, right? That's what you want to do, right? If you want to go down the academic route, or if you're just curious about experiments, you want to run these experiments, and you kind of rely on other people. You got to rely on your advisor, or there's a graduate student that can help you. And then when you go to grad school, the stakes get a little higher because now you know that the results of this experiment are going to impact the thesis that I hope I get written by September 2009. Oh, is September 2009 all the tests failed? Okay. I hope to graduate next year in 6 months. So there's this, I mean, it's a beautiful process. The academic process is is important because it's you get used to being lonely and focusing on something for a long amount of time. And yeah, you could go crazy, actually. I kind of, one of the reasons why I left grad school is because I just spent so much time alone trying to work on this problem that not a lot of people like knew about. And that felt very lonely. And now working in business, doing science in a business environment, now there's a lot of people involved because now there are 5 emails in my inbox from 5 different departments asking about the same project. And the way I have to answer them is very different. The way I talk to a chemist is going to be very different. The way do I talk to somebody who's in claims substantiation, which is different than somebody who's talking to marketing. These are all these players have functions. And if you tell marketing that you have something exciting, they're going to get so excited. They're going to go through it. They're going to want to launch it immediately. So that's like a kind of like a tiger you need to, you know, protect yourself against. But they're also a tiger that help you because you want to race to the finish line. They're your powerful ally. So you have to feed that tiger little pieces of food as you prepare the meal. And I think the communication is probably the biggest difference. You have to be a very good communicator to succeed and to get your project to continue. Because now it's September and your results did not go well, that result is either going to be dropped or, you know, you're going to have to maybe work in a different department because mm-hmm. you need to present some kind of result, even a bad result. And luckily at L'Oreal, there's, I think there was some appreciation for the complexity of some of the tasks and method development. And there's an environment where you can make mistakes. But you should always have a backup plan. You know, when you're working on your thesis in grad school, when you're doing research, you don't really think of a backup plan. You just think of like just driving your head through the wall in this specific spot. Instead, in business, you know what I learned is you have to have projects that you are confident you can finish in 3 months, and then you have projects that you're not really confident you can finish, but are really, really important. Really important. And so it requires a lot of balance of your own ego and in combination with just, you have to be a communicator. You have to learn how to talk to different departments so that either they support you or they leave you alone, you know, so that you can focus on your work. So that's something that I learned big time. And that to me is, I think, strong advice. I would encourage all students, all graduate students, undergraduate students. You've worked 80 hours on your research project. Okay, great. How about take an improv class? How about go join a club where you have to talk to people? How about be on a racetrack team or like those? Remember in school there was at Rutgers there's like a racing car team. I just thought sometimes I was like, oh, a bunch of nerds, right? But they're communicating. They're building one thing that neither a single person could build on them by themselves. That's brilliant. That's something you learn. And it's something that the faster you learn how to work with others, the better you're going to succeed in, I would think, any industry, but especially at L'Oreal, where we have 80,000 employees worldwide, multicultural. If you're jibber jabbering and saying like all the time and, you know, talking quickly on a FaceTime or a Zoom call or a Teams call, nobody's going to pay attention. Mm-hmm. And if you're full of yourself, like I've been in the past, and just think you're so smart and nobody can say anything that's wrong, you're also going to go nowhere because we're all different and you have to work with everybody's sort of common where we are in common ground. So long answer again, I'm sorry, but it's very all good. Important. Communication and check your ego.
There we go. I think it's something that people want to hear. People don't want to hear, but it is true. I think staying humble and knowing that there might be somebody that knows more than you, or there might be somebody that even if they don't know more than you, they know something different and they can shed, again, that perception, that they can change your perception on how you're designing your experiment or how you're looking at the method development. So,
right.
And then communication. Oh my gosh. Yes. Everything you said. I mean, you can't talk to everybody on the same way. They have different interests. They are trying to pull on their end. So you got to know how to communicate. But thank you so much for taking the time to shed a light on what you do, on the fact that this industry is full of passionate individuals who, I mean, you were doing biomedical engineering. You probably never thought you would end up at L'Oreal, but
right.
Here you are. You've made a career out of this, and you can inspire others to know that if they're starting out, they can really fulfill their passion in this industry. So thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you. My pleasure. And you guys are doing a good service because it's, you know, that it took a while to learn how to communicate. And I think what you're doing is at least you're giving people, you're transitioning people from the academic world to the business world. And that's very important because then you can get started right away. You'll get promoted faster. And there's a lot of good things that I think the SEC provides for students and graduate students. So congrats to you guys.
Like what you heard? The NYSEC is here to move cosmetic science forward. Stay tuned to our next episodes and visit nysec.org for more content.
Hey, Susanna Fernandez here, this year's NYSEC's chair. Don't forget about Suppliers Days, beauty's main event for innovation in ingredients and formulation taking place on November 10th and 11th at the Javits Center in New York City. There will also be a virtual day on Friday, November 12th to make it accessible for everyone in the industry. We look forward to seeing you there. Visit us at nysec.org/suppliersday today.